You're listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Thanks, everyone, for coming. I'm very happy to be moderating this discussion with this fascinating man who is a fellow here, Chris Segoyan. He is truly one of the leading privacy activists and experts in the United States. As a fellow, his project is to help create a market for privacy by compiling and presenting easy-to-understand information on the actual substantive privacy practices of telecommunications and internet companies. I'm holding here in my hand a printout of AT&T's privacy policy. It's only 23 pages long, so of course, I'm sure everyone who is a customer of AT&T, like me, have read it and have agreed to all of its terms. Actually, I lost my cell phone, my AT&T iPhone, the other day, so who knows where the government thinks I am right now. The title of Chris's talk today is Helping or Hindering How Telecom Providers Respond to Government Surveillance Requests. Despite their claims, such as in this privacy policy, to protect people's privacy, their customers' privacy, telecom companies and internet and web application providers routinely disclose their communications and other private data to law enforcement and intelligence agencies when requested. Firms like Google and Microsoft actually specifically log data in order to assist the government, and other providers like AT&T and Verizon are paid money, $1.8 million per year, to provide real-time access to customer communications records to the FBI. These companies have to comply with subpoenas, apparently, but the question is, how much information are they collecting? They have a choice whether to purge data, how much data to get, and they also have a choice about what to tell their customers when asked about the data they've collected and the data that they're giving to the government. Chris's project is kind of about creating a market or incentives for these companies to be reasonable and to truly protect their customers' privacy in the marketplace. So with that, I'm going to let Chris take it.
I think this works. Can you all hear me? Yeah? Move it up a bit.
How about that?
Yeah? Okay. So thanks for coming. You know, I've been working in the area of privacy for a couple years. Let me tell you a little bit about myself first, and then I'll get into the project and what I hope to do and that kind of stuff. So I'm a computer scientist by training. I have a master's degree in computer security. I used to break systems and design phishing attacks. When I first started graduate school, we would design new ways to trick consumers into giving up their passwords. And the idea being that if we could come up with the tricks first, then we could protect people against them before the bad guys came up with them. And it was really fun. It was, you know, involved like basically hacking human psychology. I sort of got diverted away from that into law and policy. And so I spend the vast majority of my time now with lawyers, which is very unpleasant, or very pleasant. Sorry. Some lawyers are truly lovely, particularly the ones who keep me out of jail. I've sort of pivoted towards working on privacy, working on policy. I live in Washington. And my work, both my research and my activism, is really about trying to get companies to be better about privacy, in the same way that an environmental activist might be trying to convince BP to not pollute as much. Now, the reason that companies play this role, the reason that I focus on companies is that, one, the government is not very interested in being better on privacy. So trying to convince the government to not spy on you is not going to be very effective. But two, companies are sort of, they act as our middlemen, right? So when the government wants to investigate your emails, they go to Google, and they tell you that they're going to be asking for them. You don't have the opportunity to object or to hire a lawyer or to fight it. You're relying on Google to be a good company to fight on your behalf. In legal terms, these proceedings are what are called ex parte, which means Google and the government are appearing before a judge, or rather the government's appearing before the judge and giving an order to Google. The consumer is entirely out of the loop. Do you want me to use the mic, ladies? There we go. So Google plays this role. They're sort of they're the holder of our data, right? AT&T plays the same role. Verizon plays the same role. We rely on them to protect our privacy. But in many cases, they have very skewed incentives, right? These are companies that are heavily regulated. So they are before the government on a regular basis on issues relating to privacy, antitrust, competition, mergers, blah, 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 blah. And they need to keep a good relationship with the government. And so it's going to be unlikely that these companies are going to take a particularly aggressive pro-user stance against the government if the following week it'll mean that they're being shouted at in Congress. However, companies are different. Some companies are better in the area of privacy, and some companies are worse. And I'll give you a few examples in a minute. But the important thing is that it's very difficult for consumers to know which companies are good and which companies are bad. Right, and so as an example, you know, if you walk into Best Buy and you're going to get a new cell phone, right? You walk in and they tell you, okay, well, AT&T and Verizon, they have the iPhone. And T-Mobile, they have the Samsung Nexus S, blah, 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 blah. So you can find out who has the different devices. Maybe they'll tell you, well, you know, T-Mobile has 1,000 minutes for $29.95. Right? So you can find out who is the most price competitive. Maybe they'll also say, well, you know, Verizon will let you make free calls to your friends and family after 6 p.m. Right? Or if your mom already uses Verizon, you can make unlimited calls to her. Right? So there are these social network advantages to using particular providers. But if you walk in the door and say, well, who's the best on privacy, that information isn't presented. And in fact, the salespeople at Best Buy don't know this information. Now, there are, in fact, substantive differences between the carriers, but you would never know it. And Kay was nice enough to hold up AT&T's 23-page privacy policy, which is ludicrous, right? And in fact, I don't know, those of you who enjoy crass humor like me may have seen South Park, watch South Park on a regular basis. And in fact, this last year, there was an episode that involved the iTunes terms of service in which the young boys agreed to some fairly unpleasant activities inflicted upon them by Apple in exchange for a regular iTunes update. So at first glance, it might seem like, oh, you know, these terms of service, these privacy policies, they're written by lawyers and for lawyers. The information is dense. It's not easy to understand. So maybe we should just focus on making this stuff easy to understand. Right? And in fact, there are people doing that. There are folks who are working on research to come up with a nutrition label for privacy, right? In the same way that, you know, we have standardized labels for food, we have standardized labels for credit card offers. The Schumer box is very famous for listing the interest rates and the annual fees in a standardized form. But actually, that's not enough. And the reason is that the important things that relate to privacy are not disclosed there. The stuff that's in there is sort of their COIA statements. They cover the company's ass. They're there to protect them from enforcement actions by the FTC, you know, the regulators. They're not there to actually inform consumers because consumers never read them. And so before I go into the differences between the firms, I thought it would be fun to read you a few statements from companies' privacy policies. Just to imagine that consumers are reading these things and see how a consumer could compare privacy policies. All right, so on Facebook's statements of rights and responsibilities, they say that your privacy is very important to us. That sounds really good, right? On Yahoo's page, they say that Yahoo takes your privacy seriously. Well, if they take your privacy, if your privacy is very important, is that better than taking your privacy seriously, or is that worse? Like, how do you compare those two things? Microsoft is committed to protecting your privacy. Now, that sounds really active. Microsoft is a go-getter. So that must mean that Microsoft is really serious. But in fact, Google's statement on their site, they say that they make privacy a priority in everything they do. That sounds even better. Now, if a consumer actually read these statements, what would they make of these? Right? These are fluff. They're written by lawyers for lawyers. There's nothing actually of substance in these statements. They make no promises. These are very, very vague things. We take your privacy seriously. Well, we can take it seriously while we still give your data to the government. In fact, Verizon, a few years ago, when they were being sued by EFF and the ACLU for engaging in warrantless wiretapping, they actually argued in court that they had a First Amendment right to share your data with NSA. Right? Verizon believes it has a free speech right to share your data. And this is at the same time as the company's privacy policy says that privacy is really important. Right? How do you How do you have both those things happening at the same time? So let's talk a little bit about what isn't disclosed. And I want to give you some substantive examples of the differences between the carriers and some companies so that you understand that this isn't sort of just fluff, that there are big differences and they will impact your lives. So my favorite example relates to wireless phone companies. So many of us have smartphones now, and these smartphones are internet enabled, and for those of you who understand at least a little bit about technology, there's a thing called an IP address, which is a unique address given to every computer on the internet. The IP address tells your internet company where you are, and if when you browse the web, you sort of leave your IP address behind, almost like a breadcrumb. And companies that might want to find out what you do, or divorce lawyers who might want to find out where you've been, or record companies who want to find out who's shared particular files, will use the IP address and contact your internet company and say, we saw this address sharing this movie at this time, tell us which customer had it. Right? So IP addresses are the key to revealing someone's information. Sprint keeps the list of IP addresses it assigns to its mobile phones for 2 years. Verizon keeps the list of IP addresses that it assigns to its phone for 1 year. T-Mobile doesn't keep any logs at all. Now, what does this mean? Let's say you are a consumer and you go to a restaurant down the street and you get a salad and you bite into the salad and there's a big rock and it smashes your tooth. Right, so you go onto Yelp afterwards and you say, this restaurant sucks. I destroyed my tooth. I've got all these medical bills. I'm never going back there. Oh, and they're unclean. Right, so you leave this really horrible review. Yelp is actually really important these days in electronic commerce. A negative review can actually seriously harm your ability to get new customers. Same goes for TripAdvisor for hotels. And so the restaurateur is a little bit worried. Right? He thinks that this didn't happen. And he thinks that this is one of his competitors down the road, another salad place that's freaking out. So he hires a lawyer. He asks Yelp, tell me the name of the customer who left that negative review. I want to sue them for defamation. If you are a T-Mobile customer and you left the review from your T-Mobile mobile phone, that review will never be linked back to your identity. If you're using Sprint, Verizon, or several other big companies, with just a few minutes of work, a Sprint employee will be able to pull up the information revealing what you did 2 years ago. Now, Sprint also keeps records of every web page you view through your phone, even the ones you view at 2 in the morning when you're drunk. Right? Now, if you went to Sprint's website and you looked through their 30-page privacy policy, you would never learn about their IP address collection activities. T-Mobile, which actually has a good policy, doesn't disclose this on their website either. The only reason we know about these is because I snuck into a surveillance conference 2 years ago and secretly recorded a Sprint executive bragging about this. Stephen Colbert called it a gross violation of Sprint's violation of your rights. So this is an example, and this extends beyond restaurant reviews, right? So this is a critical area of free speech. If we are to be able to speak freely, we need to be able to be anonymous in some cases. And these companies provide and have the data that's necessary to be able to revoke that anonymity. Now, maybe not every consumer wants anonymity. Maybe Sprint charges $25 less a month. But so then consumers should be able to say, well, I'm willing to pay $5 a month to have this privacy protection, but I'm not willing to pay $25. But right now, that information isn't available in the market. Another example relates to search engines. So all the big search engines retain logs of what we do. They retain logs of the search queries that we issue, what we type in on the search engine. They retain information about our IP addresses, what kind of computer we're using, where we're coming from, where we are in the world when we issue them, what time of day, how many links we click on the search results until we finally leave the page and stay away from it. And this information proves to be a bonanza for law enforcement agencies. Right, if someone murders someone else, the police will go to Google and say, hey, did they search for any information about how to bury a body? Divorce lawyers will contact search engines to find out if someone was going to online dating sites or searching for other information during the period when the marriage was falling apart. And in response to pressure from European privacy regulators, all of the search engines have now announced what are called data retention policies. This means that after a certain number of months or years, they will delete some of the data in their possession. Microsoft has probably the best policy in the market right now, which is after, I think, 9 or 12 months, they delete the entire IP address, so the entire address that can link you. They delete cookies and other things that can also be used to link you. So Microsoft just keeps the terms that were searched for, but nothing that links them to you. Google deletes the last couple digits of the IP address. And you don't need to know how an IP address works. The important thing you need to know is that this is not a very good degree of protection. And in fact, a computer scientist could very easily reverse that and figure out with some high probability that it was in fact you doing that search. So the difference between using Google or Bing in this case is that your searches will essentially remain linked indefinitely with Google with some degree of probability. And with Microsoft, after a certain period of time, the searches will not be linked to you at all. In Microsoft's case, I think it's 9 months. I can check. It's either 9 or 18 months. It's 6. They dropped it last year. There's been sort of a downward trend, or a good trend, but downward in terms of the number of months. The search engines have actually been competing in this area to have lesser and lesser data retention policies. But again, if you went to Microsoft's website, it would be very difficult to find this information. Likewise, Google says on their website that they anonymize data, but they don't say, oh, we only delete the last couple digits. This is something that would be important if you understood how this actually limits the effectiveness of what they're doing. We know, for example, that divorce lawyers now routinely go to Facebook and to Google when they're doing their cases. These companies are gold mines for data. People leave stuff behind there without really knowing it. And so, I've been looking at this for a while, and some companies are getting better, and some companies are actually, in fact, getting worse. Yahoo used to have the best data retention policy in the business, and then they now have the worst. They decided that they weren't getting sufficient recognition in the market for their pro-privacy activities, and so the business side of the company was able to overrule the privacy side, and they now retain data forever. So I've been trying to work on this for a while. After spending 2 years in DC, I now have pretty good data on all of the big companies. I know who is keeping data, how long they're keeping it for, who's encrypting your data, which means that it prevents people, your data from going out the door when the government arrives. I know how much the companies are charging when law enforcement does arrive, and that's because the law permits companies to charge the government for assistance. I have invoices that Yahoo has sent to the government. I have invoices that Google has sent to the government. Quick pop quiz, how much do you think your inbox is worth to the Department of Justice with Google? Any guesses? Any guesses, folks? Come on, throw a number out.
One inbox.
Your email inbox, how much do you think it's worth?
$1.
$1, okay, come on, you're worth more than that. $300. Okay, your inbox is worth $25 with Google. Yahoo charges $20 plus the cost of a stamp. Every time the post office raises the postage rates, Yahoo's surveillance prices go up by the same number of pennies. I have the invoices. They speak for themselves. A wiretap costs $3,000. The phone companies charge a lot of money for wiretaps in comparison to the internet companies. In fact, one of the things I've been trying to do is to encourage companies like Google and Yahoo and Facebook to start raising their prices, because when it costs more to surveil, the government does it less. Anyway. So this information doesn't exist in an easily accessible form right now. I think it should be available. I don't think that most consumers care about privacy, but I do think that some consumers care about privacy. And particularly when you explain it to people, they're like, oh, that's interesting. Maybe I'll consider that the next time I buy a phone or the next time I sign up for a service. What I will be doing is creating a Consumer Reports style website, right? Consumer Reports reviews washing machines and other appliances, which get the whitest whites, which use the least amount of electricity, that kind of stuff. And I'll be doing that for services like the email providers, search engines, online backup services, telephone companies, services that consumers are using, providing them with easy to understand information, rating them on A to F, thumbs up, thumbs down, without consumers having to get into the nitty-gritty of how these privacy features work. There are some companies that are doing good things on privacy, but they don't get recognition in the market, like Yahoo, like Yahoo used to do. And there are some companies that are particularly bad on privacy, and they don't get suitably beaten up in the market. And so I'm hoping that by making this information salient and accessible and understandable, that I can try and incentivize companies to try and to be a little bit better. So let's have a chat now. Thank you.
You know you speak well when the news is all bad and you get applauded anyway. I'll start out with one question, Chris. We've talked about this a little bit, but you said you've snuck into a surveillance conference. You've done other investigative journalism to find this out. Can you talk a little bit about your experiences? What's been the best goldmine for information? Has it been your work getting doing FOIA requests or what?
Yeah, so I have some slightly unconventional research methods. You know, when I first started my PhD, I thought I would be comparing companies' practices and analyzing the amount of surveillance that happens today. And there's so little information available when I started about those two things that most of my work actually went into finding out how much surveillance happens and what companies do and what their policies are. Some of the more interesting research methods I've followed, so I've done FOIA requests. I probably file at least two or three per week. They're really easy. It takes about 5 minutes work. It takes probably a lot longer for the government to respond, but on my end, it's two or three a week. I filed a request to BART in San Francisco to find out about their shutdown of cell phones. You may have read about that in the news. I got back probably 200 pages of documents about their agreements with the phone companies of who owns the equipment and when they can shut it down and that kind of stuff. I actually just filed my first ever federal lawsuit in court 2 months ago. I filed requests for documents relating to cell phone surveillance. The Department of Justice found 600 pages and refused to give me a single page. So it turns out it's really expensive to file a lawsuit. It's $350 just to file. And then you have to pay $150 to have someone else deliver the piece of paper to the person you're suing. So I went online and I raised money, and in one day I raised $1,200, which is really cool. I didn't even have to sell cookies. I thought I was gonna have to do a bake sale. So I'm gonna be probably appearing in court in the next month or two. I'm representing myself. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm pro se. I'm like copying and pasting paragraphs from other people's briefs into mine. But the best part is if I lose, the only thing that happens is I don't get the data, right? It's not like I'm gonna go to jail if I screw up. So that's gonna be a really fun experience. Let's see, what else have I done? So because, I'll talk about that one in a minute, but because my research is about what companies do and how they relate to the government, the DC is sort of the headquarters of where I need to be, right? If I were doing any other kind of tech stuff, I'd be in San Francisco, where all the companies are. But the teams within the companies that respond to government requests are largely based out of DC, or at least the people who manage those teams. They're all former government people. And so I spend a lot of time in bars drinking with these people. And they tell me things after a few drinks. The trick that I learned when I first moved to DC is to drink club soda with a bit of lime in it, because it looks like a gin and tonic, and then let them buy themselves whatever they want. So I don't even buy drinks because I've been broke. I've been a graduate student for the past few years. But they will drink with me, and after a few drinks, they will let me know. Usually, they don't let me know about what they're doing. They tell me about what their competitors are doing. And they each rat each other out, which is great. So I get documents leaked to me that way. I get, you know, manila envelopes passed over the bar. It's straight out of the movies. It's really cool. And then in 2009, I went to a conference called ISS World. This is nicknamed the Wiretapper's Ball. It's where the companies that make surveillance equipment go and show off their wares to government agencies and telephone companies. This is like whatever the new wiretapping gear is, they go and show it off. And I was working for the Federal Trade Commission at the time. I was their first ever technologist. This is the agency that protects privacy. And the conference was open to anyone with a .gov email address. And I had a .gov email address. I had a badge because I worked for the government. And so I went to the conference. And DC, for those of you who remember the Monica Lewinsky case, DC is a one-party consent city, which means that as long as one person in the room knows the conversation is being recorded, it's OK. And I was that one person. So I recorded two panels at the conference. This is entirely legal. entirely legal. So there was a panel in which phone company executives bragged about their surveillance capabilities. So Sprint has 100 employees doing nothing but surveillance. And the executive from Sprint was saying that it was so much work to respond to the government's requests, particularly for cell phone location data, that Sprint decided that it didn't want to be in the business of facilitating each individual request. So Sprint set up a special website where law enforcement could log in and get your GPS information whenever they wanted. And so this executive was bragging about the success of this website. And in fact, in the first year, it was used 8 million times. So I recorded this. I didn't know what I was going to record, right? But I figured, if I hear anything interesting, no one's ever going to believe me. So I recorded it, and then after working with several lawyers to make sure my release of the information was legal, I published it online, and Stephen Colbert played that recording on his show. So that was pretty fun. It was also really scary to have this information that I knew that I knew that no one else in my community knew. And I really wanted to get it out there, but I didn't really want to upset the government so much they would come after me. So I suspect those are probably the top methods. I've gotten a unique set of data. Oops, sorry, let me turn this off. I've gotten data that really no one else has. Most computer scientists write algorithms or write new programs, and we don't really usually FOIA stuff, and we don't. I'm in the final stages of finishing my dissertation right now, and it's been a very interesting process working with my committee to get them to approve the footnotes, which will cite a conversation with anonymous source X or anonymous source Y. It's not usual in computer science to be citing anonymous sources, but I'm not able to reveal their names, otherwise they'll get fired. It's been strange and interesting sort of combining these journalistic techniques or investigative techniques with computer science and law.
Great. I think you, madame, had your hand up first, and then Sandy, and then.
Thank you very much for your interesting talk, sorry. And you made me very grateful that my BlackBerry uses T-Mobile. You mentioned that companies like Yahoo, for example, changed their privacy policies because they had business incentives to cooperate with the US government. I wonder if your research has looked at the same sort of cost-benefit analysis for companies working with foreign governments and how much, we saw the situation with Google in China, but how much are companies making business decisions about privacy because of the profitability to be gained in other countries? And are you going to be revealing that information on your website?
Thanks. So thank you. That's a really interesting question. Let's delve into that a little bit briefly. So let me clarify first that Yahoo did not extend their data retention period because of government pressure. They extended it because of business pressure. Right. So in most of the companies, it's not the privacy people inside the company versus the government surveillance people. It's the privacy people versus the business people who want to monetize your data. And you have to step back and remember that. So you or your employer is paying $50 a month for your telephone, but your email service is provided to you for free. And your social networking service through Facebook is provided to you for free. And so these companies have to monetize that in some way. There's a sort of phrase in my community, which is that if you're not paying for the product, you are the product. Right? You are the product on Facebook. Your data is being bought and sold, and Facebook goes out of its way to incentivize you to give them as much of your data as possible so that they can then allow advertisers to target you with that data. So Facebook, more than any other company, allows advertisers to micro-target users. As an advertiser, you can go on Facebook and say, I want to target women between the age of 21 and 22 who live in Williamsburg, who like the following five bands and play golf. Right? No one else can do that. No other advertising company can do that because no other advertising company has that kind of data. To get you to give them that data, Facebook gives you this really cool service and then uses social coercion through your friends so that you feel forced to use the service and to update it and upload your photos and check in regularly and blah, 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 blah. So just want to clarify that it's not the government that is pressuring these companies to keep data, but when the company decides to keep data or to collect more data for business purposes, then the government can come in and ask for it. And there's another phrase that's popular in my community, which is stolen from the movie Field of Dreams, which is, if you build it, they will come. If you have the data, the government will come for it eventually. The only way to stop the government from getting it is to not have it in the first place. So with regard to foreign governments, there are some really interesting things happening right now. And I actually have a slightly different position than most privacy activists. But let me say first that companies get very bad press in the Western media when they give users' data to the Chinese government, or to the Vietnamese government, or to any government in a country that doesn't respect human rights, although it's not entirely clear that we respect human rights in this country. The issue to consider here is that when we in this country use products provided by companies like Google and Facebook that are based in the US, these companies have to provide our data to the government when they're legally required to do so, when the government has the appropriate order, whether it's a subpoena or a search warrant or whatever it is, they're required to hand it over. When the US government is interested in the communications of Indian citizens or Iranian citizens, if they are using Google or Facebook, the US government can also get those foreigners' information, actually easier than they can get the information of people located in the US. The Indian government has a much tougher time getting information from, say, Facebook. And the general rule of thumb is that if the company has an office in a country, they have to disclose data. That doesn't mean if they keep people's data in the country, right? So as an example, Google doesn't keep any data in Brazil. And so a few years ago, the Brazilian government went to Google and said, we want to know about people using Orkut, which is the social network that's only popular in Brazil and India, but now Facebook is sort of taking over. We want to know about people sharing child porn on Orkut. And Google said, sorry, we don't have any data in Brazil. We're not giving you anything. And the Brazilians said, oh, okay, well, we're going to arrest your entire marketing team, and then we'll see how we'll see how things go. And Google very promptly developed a protocol to give the Brazilians their data. Right? There is no way to say no to a government request when you have employees in the field. And there's a great quote from Eric Schmidt. He was interviewed by Rachel Maddow a couple years ago at the Davos Forum. And he says, there's a problem with expecting companies to protect you against the government. And that's that the government has guns and we don't. And I mean, this is probably one of the most honest things that Eric Schmidt has ever said in the area of privacy. If the company has an office in India, they can be coerced to give people their data. What's happening now that you're seeing, if you've read articles about the Indians trying to coerce BlackBerry or RIM into providing back doors into their services, what you're seeing is that the Indians and the Iranians and other governments are pissed off. They're pissed off because they don't have the lawful access, what they call lawful access capabilities to access their citizens' data that the US has over its own citizens, and in some cases over their citizens' data. This issue leads to lots of bad press for companies. I mean, it's a huge, huge issue. I'll be discussing it for a while when I'm at the IGF meeting, the Internet Governance Forum meeting in Kenya next week. But the companies are sort of stuck in the middle. On one side, they're getting beaten up in the Western press. Why are you giving your data to the Chinese government? Blah, blah, blah. These people are being arrested. Yet at the same time, if they don't do it, they don't get to be in the country. And Google has said, okay, we're not going to make money in China. You know, we're going to just pull out. But Microsoft is in their full strength. Cisco is in their full strength because they don't want to give up these profits.
If the incentive in the U.S., you were saying, is it's not about coercion, it's about money. It's a business incentive. So wouldn't it stand to reason then that these same companies would be really susceptible to being bought off by, say, the Vietnamese government, even if they aren't legally bound in the same way that they are in, say, the U.S.?
I think it would be problematic visually for Google to sell its customers' data to the Vietnamese government. However, if they have the data already and then they're forced to, well, that's a different story. Then they're just complying with local laws, right? It's seen as sordid to sort of sell things to government, especially if people get arrested as a result. There are certainly companies like Lexis and Westlaw and some of these database companies that sell databases to the government. But
Google and Yahoo and Microsoft, they're not stupid enough to engage in that. Just not because it's illegal, but because it just looks really bad. All right, there were some more questions.
It somewhat follows up on Abby's question. I'm sure we're all kind of stunned about how little privacy we have. And from what I remember of law school is that an individual is entitled to privacy in areas where there's a reasonable expectation of privacy. So I would reasonably expect a lot of information on that I use on my computer to be private. Have there been court decisions which say we have no reasonable expectation of privacy on the internet?
So I'm not a lawyer, but I can talk like one when it comes to the internet. So there are two cases on point here, U.S. v. Miller and Smith v. Maryland from the I think 60s, that created what's called the third-party doctrine. And without going into all the details of the law, generally, if you give your private information to a third party, your bank, your phone company, Google, Microsoft, you have no reasonable expectation of privacy over that data. And in fact, all of the protections that we have with our data online are statutory, not constitutional. There's in fact going to be a case at the Supreme Court on November 8th called the Jones case, which is about the government placing GPS tracking devices under cars and tracking people without warrants. But that's about the government surveilling you directly with regard to things that you voluntarily give to companies. There's very little privacy. Judges around the country have sort of staged a revolt in some areas with regards to data that you don't know you give companies. So for example, you know you're using a cell phone. You know you're calling someone else, so you know that the phone company can find out the telephone number you're dialing. Most consumers, though, don't realize that whenever they have their phone on, that it can be the location information can be obtained and given to the government. So one of the appeals courts, I think in the Third Circuit, recently ruled that because consumers are not going out of their way to communicate their location information, therefore they have a reasonable expectation of privacy in that. But this area of the law, it really sucks. The main law in it, the main statute on the books is called the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. It dates from 1986. As you know, the internet in 1986 is very different than today. Under the law right now, the moment you open an email and read it once, even if it's for like 2 seconds on your phone, it loses warrant protections and it can be accessed with a subpoena. Emails that are in your sent folder or your outgoing folder can be accessed without a court order. Emails that have been in storage for over 180 days, so with Google you keep your emails forever, all of those can be accessed without a court order as well. I mean, the law is so hopelessly broken. And then I think there's a question from the woman next to you. Did you have one? Okay. All right, the two gentlemen.
20 questions, but let's just...
We can get coffee later if you want.
Okay. I guess, Mike, a lot of what you're talking about kind of is a tension around the power of markets versus the power of governments. And you said near the beginning of your talk that you'd kind of given up on the possibility of a solution to these problems coming from the government. You mentioned that you worked in government around these issues as well. So it'd be really interesting to hear a bit more about why you think the solution to this can't come from some kind of privacy bill of rights from government, right? And I mean, I'm thinking that, if you think about the incentive situation that you mentioned, about the guy who posts a bad review on a Yelp website. That kind of situation is quite unusual. I mean, it's a bit like the situation of thinking about incentives when you're buying a car, right? Safety is not a big incentive when you buy a car because you assume that it's highly unlikely that that's going to affect you. But you're going to use the car every day, so other things like efficiency are going to be much more relevant, right? But the impact of bad car safety on society as a whole is huge, right? So government regulates. Isn't it similar with these kind of issues where, most people aren't going to be affected by these privacy issues, but once in a while there are going to be people who are affected, and the damage that does to society is a problem. So it's government that really has to step in here.
So that's a great question. There's actually like 5 questions hidden in there, very 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 sneakily. Good one. So let me talk about the last thing you said first, which I think is really fun, which is that consumers don't think about safety when they buy cars. Parents buy Volvos more than anyone else, not because they're flash looking, right, but because Volvo has the best safety record. The huge problem of Americans buying SUVs, right, it's not because they have something to compensate for. It's because they feel like they're safer. They don't want a small car because they're worried about other people with SUVs plowing into them. I mean, we have an arms race there of sorts. But I actually do think that safety for people who have someone to worry about, right, it plays a factor in their purchasing decision. And I think that some consumers are going to care about privacy. Now, this doesn't mean that all consumers are going to care, but even if it's just 5% of the market, you know, companies can make a very, very good amount of money. They can pay for all their costs with just 5% of consumers. And so I think that if we can just grow or at least nurture that 5% and give them a way to find products that suit their needs, I think that will then incentivize the companies that are not catering to their needs, right? Everyone benefits through that kind of stuff. Now, with regard to the government, I'm very cynical. I think that's what happens when you spend time in Washington. I have assisted with committee staff with drafting bills and holding hearings and I see the questions that members ask. I see the amendments that they put forth. I see the bills that come out. And the chance of comprehensive privacy legislation getting passed in the next year or two is zero. And in fact, the chances are bad legislation will be passed. So as an example, just a few months ago, a bill that would require that US internet companies retain IP addresses, require them to keep it for a period of 18 months, was passed out of committee. The bill was called the Protecting Children from Online Pornography Act of 2011. Now, who in their right mind is going to vote no for a bill with that name? So I work for the Federal Trade Commission, which is the only agency we have that's tasked with protecting consumer privacy, and they are not permitted to meddle in things outside of the area of consumer privacy. Right, so the FTC has no official position on stuff that the Department of Justice or NSA does. In Canada or in Europe or in Australia or in Hong Kong, they have data protection commissioners who in the same day will be giving statements about how much Facebook sucks and then talk about body scanners at airports or Echelon or government surveillance. Right? The privacy commissioners in these other countries have a broad portfolio. In the US, the FTC only does consumer privacy. And in fact, the FTC as an agency is living in fear. The reason for this is in the 70s, I think it was the 70s, they tried to regulate advertisements for sugary cereal to kids. And Republicans and then Sugar State Democrats got together, zeroed out the FTC's budget to punish them for doing this. For several months, the FTC ran entirely on filing fees from companies' antitrust submissions. And then eventually, when they got some money back from Congress, they were forbidden from doing any regulation in the area of advertising for several years. The FTC has like a deep psychological scar now. They're living in fear of going too far over the line, being too aggressive in any area, and then getting smacked down by Congress. And so expecting the FTC to say, do something that will intentionally protect consumers from the government, not going to happen. Where you have seen some interesting things, there is where the FTC can do something that will have an unintended, or at least visually unintended consequence to protect consumers from the government. So as an example, Google in 2010 turned on encryption by default for Gmail. You see the lock icon when you're connecting to Gmail now. The FTC issued a public, one of the FTC commissioners gave a speech in March of 2010 calling on all companies to follow Google's lead. Now she wasn't saying do that to protect people against the NSA or to protect people against the Iranian government. She was pointing to the threat of hackers at Starbucks. However, it just so happens that the technology to protect you from the hacker at Starbucks is also the one to protect you against NSA or the Iranians. And in fact, some of you may have read in the news this week that an Iranian hacker broke into a company and used some technology he stole to monitor 300,000 Iranian Google users, and the reason they had to do that was because Iran can no longer easily monitor Gmail communications. The actions of the FTC, I think, played a big role in getting Google and then other companies. So Facebook will more than likely be announcing something similar in the next month or two, which will piss off a lot of people in the Middle East. So I don't expect the government to do anything. We were supposed to have this Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board that Obama still hasn't assigned or nominated enough people to actually have it running. So yeah, it would be great if we had a privacy bill, but for now we have to rely on activists and class action lawyers and companies. And then Ian and Ed, how much time do we have? Oh, awesome. Okay, we can keep going.
Well, maybe it just sort of follows up on that a bit. I wondered the difference overseas, having lived in Germany for a while, you mentioned European privacy regulators had forced the companies to reduce the amount of time that they keep. I remember when Google Street View was introduced in Germany a couple of years ago, there was this outcry that, oh my God, you know, you're going to be seeing people's faces walking down the street. And I think they had to, in Germany, or at least, I don't know if that was extended elsewhere, but they had to anonymize people's faces on Google Street View. I just wonder, what is the difference, you think, for the public opinion? I mean, there seems to be sort of an outcry there, and I suppose you could say German history or whatever, but maybe the question is, why is it so different in the United States? Is it because of, is it money? Is it the security apparatus after 9/11 having undue influence, or how do you see that?
So I think it's several factors, but let me throw out one word that I think will help to explain why Germany cares about privacy: Stasi. Right? There are people alive in Germany today who were living at a time when there were secret police keeping files on average people. Right? The memory of the knock on the door is alive today in Germany. And I think that affects their psyche in a deep way. You know, right now there is a petition that's been circulating. There's a movement against expanded data retention in Germany. There are tens of thousands of people who've signed a petition against this. It's never happened in the States. Right? If they can get 50,000 signatures in Germany, then I think they get a hearing or something in the parliament. This is a major, major political issue in Germany. And I think it's largely due to those memories. We don't have the memory of that in this country. I mean, the last time we really had the police going door to door was, you know, when the Crown was here, which is why we have the Fourth Amendment. But no one is alive today who was around when that happened. You know, Americans are said to be more distrusting of the government than Europeans, but our laws are really bad. What I will say, though, is that the Europeans have these really, they have these great data protection commissioners. They have public outcry over these issues, but then they get very little enforcement. It's a curiosity that you don't actually see companies being sued or shut down for privacy violations. Whereas, for example, Google had to settle with the FTC over Buzz and had to change a lot of its privacy practices due to FTC settlement early this year. Surprising that the Europeans were not able to extract similar provisions. So we have this strange situation where you have very weak laws in the US, but very strong enforcement from the FTC. In Europe, you have broad enforcement power, but they don't really use it. But you at least have public support. I will say one other thing. So last year and the year before, there was a scandal because Google's Street View vehicles, the vehicles that were going around and taking photos of everyone, were also surreptitiously collecting Wi-Fi data. And in fact, they were collecting all the data going over all the Wi-Fi networks near the vehicle, not just the names of the networks, but everything that people were sending back and forth. So they captured passwords and emails and web pages that people were viewing. I mean, they got everything. The way we found out about that is that when the Street View scandal was blowing up in Europe, one of the German data protection commissioners, I think it was a German one, said, we'd like to see one of these vehicles. So Google set up like a show and tell, where they brought one of the vehicles to, you know, some place, and they invited these officials to come and look at it. And so they walked around it, and they saw these little lenses. And there was like a hole in the side of the vehicle. And one of the officials said, well, what goes there? And they said, oh yeah, that's where the hard drive goes. And he said, well, I'd like to see the hard drive, please. And they said, well, you know, it's not available right now. And he says, okay, well, you know, I'd like you to deliver the hard drive from one of your vehicles in the next few weeks. And so when Google's lawyers in the US were processing, you know, getting ready to deliver it, they said, well, we should probably look at the hard drive first to see what's on it before we hand it over. And then they said, oh, shit, we've been collecting this Wi-Fi data. So apparently none of the lawyers at Google knew that the Wi-Fi data was being collected. But the only reason anyone found out about it was because the Germans were inquisitive and said, what's this? Now, the sad thing, though, is no one has busted Google for the Wi-Fi collection. They've been sued all over the world. But none of the data protection commissioners have actually extracted any real fines or anything as a result. Any more questions? Yes.
My name is Archana, and I oversee our immigration portfolio in the United States. And my question is around how do you build a larger movement in support of privacy? And the reason my entry point into this is through the immigrant rights movement. And so, as you may know, with the failure to secure a comprehensive immigration reform, the battle has moved to enforcement. And so one of the enforcement proposals on the table is a piece of legislation called E-Verify. And so E-Verify is collecting all this, internet-based, trying to collect all this data of employers, of employees, and theoretically undocumented employees. And it's interesting because many of our grantees have their hands up in the air around this work. But the arguments against this work is around efficiency and cost. And so that's, for me, that seems to be a very poor argument. And so the question becomes, one, what are the arguments against it in terms of with a privacy lens? And the second question is around how do you connect the work that you're doing with the work that my grantees are doing?
So maybe you should ask yourself that question, because there's more of a movement around immigration than there is around privacy. Privacy is actually a very niche issue. Maybe you could be giving me tips as to how to create a movement around this. With regard to the cost motivation for these things, I would suggest that there are lovely opportunities for FOIAs there. Because in my experience, whenever the government rolls out something new, it's never cheap, and it never comes in at the price they expect it to be. And if you can document waste, corruption, or even better, that the thing isn't working, then you can destroy them. Right? So as an example, one of the things that some of my colleagues in the privacy community have done, they've been fighting the body scanners, the nude body scanners at airports. And before that, they were fighting the puffer machines that would shoot air at you. So the puffer machines were obscenely expensive, would get jammed up, and then didn't actually find any explosives. Right? So you have a lovely combination of three things. And then there were lobbyists selling the machines who used to work for the committees, because it's usual DC thing, right? So you have corruption, ineptitude, inefficiency, and price. Lovely things upon which to fight these devices. With the nude body scanners, you have the additional factor of cancer. So TSA agents now have higher than average cancer rates of other airport staff, people standing around these machines. TSA refuses to allow the staff or their union to give their employees the little devices that you hang on that measure radioactivity, the things that people wear in nuclear plants, right? Because they don't want this data to exist that they can verify the claims. And so folks like the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, have been kicking ass and taking names in their FOIA lawsuit and getting these documents that showing how expensive the machines are, how they don't work, how the fact that you can conceal explosives in rolls of fat, I mean, it's really sort of gross. But the machines don't work. Right, and so as a result, you now have libertarian Republicans voting to cut off TSA's funding and voting to deny appropriations for new machines, not because they think they violate privacy, but because they think they're a waste of money. If you can turn this from an issue about protecting immigrants' rights to reducing wasteful government spending in a time of austerity, then you have an entirely new audience on your side. And the way to get that data is through FOIA. FOIA is such a wonderful thing. It's so frustrating at times. I almost feel like a little kid with like a big brother or big sister like holding the ball above my head. Like I know what I want, I can see it, and they won't give it to me. But every once in a while I get something good, and then it's front page news. And if you can get some documents, if you can get some emails showing that they know this is a waste of money or they know it isn't gonna work, you can show that someone's brother has been employed to set this up, then you have a winner. And I would actually encourage you to do that rather than privacy, because, so one of the things I found in trying to fight data retention, and particularly helping in the House of Representatives, is that the members of Congress who are not on the side of privacy, in their mind, they've sort of weighed privacy and security, and they've decided that security is more important than privacy. And going to testify before them or writing them letters and saying, you have to protect privacy, it's a waste of your time. They've already made that up. Politicians do not want to flip-flop, right? And they're not going to say, oh, you know what? Privacy is actually a little bit more important. If you can convince them it's a waste of money, or even better, that it makes people less safe, then it's a winner. The other thing I would suggest is to use the example that we have from South Korea. So Korea is a very internet-dominated society. They have like gigabit Wi-Fi everywhere, gigabit Ethernet in every hotel room and every apartment. Everyone plays video games all the time. And the Koreans were really, really concerned about people pretending to be other people online and engaging in cyberbullying and that kind of stuff. And so the Korean government passed a law that required that all social networking sites and all blogs or any places that allowed people to comment, that people give their Korean equivalent social security number when they're leaving a comment or signing up for the site. So if you signed up for the Korean version of Facebook, you had to give them your social security number so they could verify that you were who you said you were, that you were in fact female or male or whatever. Some companies didn't like complying with this, and in fact, Google does not allow any comments on the YouTube videos for YouTube Korea. If you want to leave a comment, you get redirected to the YouTube in the US. That's how they get around the law. Anyway, about 2 months ago, Chinese hackers broke into the most popular Korean social networking site and stole 35 million Korean social security numbers. Whoops. So shortly after that, the Korean government decided that it would be doing away with the entire program. They'd realized that by requiring companies to collect this data, they were creating essentially a honeypot for hackers, and that there was no way to get the companies to adequately protect it. This was a ticking time bomb, and that it was better that the data just not exist in all these different places. And so they've killed off the entire mandatory registration program for all sites. Sites are in fact no longer permitted to retain this data at all. I don't think people are going to be too sympathetic to protecting immigrants from identity theft, but if you can maybe argue that people who were immigrants at one point but are now US citizens are in the database, then you have a stronger argument there. If you can find out that these databases have ever been hacked or that any of the backup tapes have been lost, again, you have an argument for protection there.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you are. Well, we're all giving you money. So lots of doom and gloom. Well, the thing is, I mean, we as consumers, one of the reasons perhaps why privacy hasn't quite taken hold is because we're okay with some of our privacy being not protected. But I guess after all this, I mean, there's a question of which provider you choose. But are there tools and strategies that we can employ with our existing providers that will mean that we leave less of a data trail? And some of it might be highly technical, but are there simple things that we as consumers can do with our existing, whatever, whether we're T-Mobile or AT&T, or whether we use Google or Bing? Are there specific things that you can think of?
Yeah, so I think about this a lot. My girlfriend's an environmental activist, and so like environmental activists will say like you should recycle, you should turn the lights off when you're not using them, you should, you know, replace all the bulbs in your house with, you know, the lower wattage bulbs, you get insulation, blah, blah, blah. There are things that you can do to make a difference. And I debate this a lot with her because my understanding is that most of the energy consumption comes from industry, not from like the light bulbs that we use in our house. But whatever, people feel good about that, and then maybe they will then like, you know, it'll internalize it and they'll become more aware of the environment. The things you can do to protect your privacy online are so trivial and silly and will have so little impact to protect you. There's not any point. There's no point in, say, like a public awareness campaign like delete your cookies, clear your browser cache. It's pointless. There are so many ways to track you. And in fact, consumers today, whether they know it or not, are engaged in an arms race. Because every new privacy technology that gets rolled out, even assuming that 5% of consumers use it, the ad networks and the other entities that track consumers are finding ways around it. So I think it's a waste of time to try and get consumers to like be better about their data. There are steps you can take if you want to protect yourself against like stalkers. So for example, there are companies like Intellius that are these people search services where someone can type your name in, and these companies for 99 cents will tell them everywhere you've lived, where you live now, where you've worked. Really, really creepy stuff. So you can opt out of many of these services. And that in many cases requires like filling out a form and sending it in the mail, like getting it stamped by notary. They make it as much of a pain in the ass as possible so that you won't do it. But you can actually opt out of those services, and that may have a material impact on like your safety, right? I personally don't want my home address on the web. That's something you can do. One of the things that I want to stress, though, is that I don't think consumers have knowingly given up their privacy in exchange for services. And I also don't think that consumers feel that happy about what is happening. So I don't think consumers like Facebook. I think consumers think of Facebook the same way you think of Comcast or Verizon. You use them because you have to use them, but you hate them, right? You hate dealing with them. You hate having to talk with them. You hate it when the bill comes at the end of the month. Like, you feel like you're being ripped off, but you don't want to go without what they're offering. They're basically utilities, right? And utilities are never known for their customer service because they don't have to compete, right? It's Comcast or no TV, or it's the electric company or no electricity, and it's Facebook, or you don't get invited to your college roommate's wedding, right? The social cost of opting out of Facebook is so ridiculously high, right? I don't have a Facebook account. I don't have a Google Plus account. I don't get invited to like all these parties that my friends are organizing. Like, those who think about me will be like, oh yeah, let me send you the email because you're a Luddite, because you're living in a cave. And to not have a Facebook account today, it's almost like not having a cell phone, right? And remember the days before cell phones when you would like talk to your friends, and you'd be like, okay, we're all gonna meet at 6 o'clock here, right? Now you like text them from the train. Well, I guess you can't do it from the train in New York because there's no service here. But when you get above ground, you text them and you're like, okay, where are you? You can do just in time or last minute planning. And if you have that one friend who doesn't have a cell phone, you still have to do that whole 6 p.m. at Union Station business. And if they're not there when you show up, you have no way of finding them, right? And it's soon after a few experiences of like not finding them at the station, you stop inviting them. They get left out. And I think that people pay a really high cost for that. People pay a really high cost for not using Facebook. And so even the friends I know who've said, all right, I'm showing them my Facebook account, 6 months later, back they were. And it's not that because they love the service, they cannot do without it.
Is Google Plus better than Facebook in terms of privacy?
No problem.
So being better than Facebook on privacy, it's like being less evil than Dick Cheney. It's not something you want to brag about. Has Google spent more time thinking about privacy than Facebook? Yes. Are there better privacy settings and controls? Yes. Are your friends using Google Plus if you're not a technologist? No. So you don't really have any choice. And it's not like you can decide to go to Google Plus and then all your friends will follow you. You will start using it once the conversations shift there. And Google Plus is largely about computer geeks right now. And until that changes, until your friends from high school are there, maybe you don't want to speak to your friends from high school, but until the people you actually want to speak to are there, you're then just going to have two accounts. You're going to have a Facebook account and a Google Plus account. You're not going to have any better privacy. You're going to now have twice as many privacy settings to manage, twice as many chances of screwing up and having something go out that you don't want to go out. So I don't think it's necessarily an improvement.
So I have a question. I've just been thinking about this, and maybe there's a very simple answer to it. But let's say, you know, I'm your average consumer. I'm like the most average consumer you'll ever have. Commercials will sell me on anything. So if I'm standing here and I mean, let's say I just don't care if the government gets my IP address because I'm not doing anything illegal. I say that, you know, or
I have nothing to hide, right?
Yeah, right. Exactly. So, I mean, how do you win over those people in this campaign? When does privacy in this sector become sort of a general good that someone like me would say yes on the privacy versus security debate? I always opt for privacy.
So the first thing is that it's not always a privacy versus security debate. So you can actually have both. Now the I have nothing to hide argument comes up every time someone talks about privacy. And the response to that, I mean, there are some fun responses, right? But you're wearing clothing. You have curtains or blinds in your house, right? You don't broadcast the medications that you take to everyone in the world. You don't broadcast your salary to everyone unless you live in India where everyone wants to know your salary for some reason. I just got back from India and that's all people wanted to talk about. Right, so there are things that we do keep private. There are really things that we keep private. However, I recognize that most consumers will not seek things out. So there's this great book by Cass Sunstein called Nudge that sort of made the rounds a while ago. Sort of the So like a Malcolm Gladwell book, making behavioral economics accessible to the average person. And so what one of the things he describes in this is that consumers stick with the default settings, right? When your 401k plan is chosen for you by your employer, you stick with the one they give you. If your employer has chosen a relatively aggressive one, the chance of you getting wiped out is pretty high because you'll never change it. When countries default to organ donation, they have higher organ donation rates than when people have to opt into organ donation. When children will pick whatever food is at eye level in the cafeteria. So if you put the pizza on the top shelf and the salads at eye level, kids pick healthy food. So he describes this as libertarian paternalism. Companies can do the right thing by consumers by making the safe options the default options, right? Facebook chooses to make your data public by default because they know it'll make them more money. But Facebook could make things private by default. And in fact, that's what Google Plus does. Google obviously got a lot of negative feedback after some of their previous products. And so they decided, OK, we're going to go safety by default. The reason I have spent so much of my time focusing on companies is, I'm definitely going to be focusing on consumers with this new project, but the reason I've spent so much time focusing on companies is because if you can get the company to change the default setting, you win. You win without having to convince every individual consumer to make a choice. And convincing every individual consumer to make a choice is really tough. And so as a really good example, 2 months ago, AT&T changed the default voicemail settings to protect against like Murdoch-style voicemail hackers. This is something I'd like been talking to the company about for months. And then the Murdoch scandal came up, and I was like, aha, I'm going to use this. And I was demonstrating how to hack voicemail on the CBS Evening News. I was like sending every press clip to the AT&T people saying, I'm going to keep dragging you through the mud until you fix this. And like last month, they fixed it, which is great. But it's so much easier to bully one company into changing one setting than trying to convince 80 million consumers to like press 7, then press 4, and then enter a PIN number, and then hope you don't forget the PIN number, blah, 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 right? Companies can act in a way to protect their customers, and it's so much more efficient. And then the companies are in a good place to inform the consumers. It's always better to work with the company than fight against them. So that's why I spend so much of my time. But the companies that don't want to do the right thing need to be shamed for it, and that's why I'm creating this new platform.
Started using privacy in their purchasing decisions, which is the teenagers of London, who've all bought BlackBerry phones, which are harder for the police to get the messages off than Gmail or whatever else they were using before. And those are the kids that organised the riots in London recently using their BlackBerries. So I don't know if that's a good news story or a bad news story, but it'd be interesting to get your comments.
How many kids in London do you know with BlackBerries?
Well, reportedly...
Not reportedly, how many do you know?
I know a hell of a lot, actually.
Okay, and I mean, so my
a lot of the teenagers I know have started buying BlackBerries in the last year or so.
So my niece is in London, and she has a BlackBerry, and her friends all have BlackBerries, but they didn't buy them because they're difficult to tap. They bought them because they really like the BlackBerry messaging service. And BlackBerries are usually sold for free with a contract. So they're the cheapest smartphones you can get. They have this easy to use messaging services where you can email or talk to your friends without paying per fee text message fees, right? So I think it's actually the economics that's driving the deployment of BlackBerries, not privacy features. It's also worth noting that I'm fairly certain that the government had easy access to the RIM messages. The government has made like a bit of a fuss and posturing about how difficult it was, but there's no encryption for consumer BlackBerry messages. The encryption that exists that all the Indian governments and the Iranian governments are complaining about is the enterprise, the service provided to companies where the company manages the BlackBerries in-house. If you walk into the Verizon store and buy a BlackBerry, your private messages go through Verizon servers. Verizon can hand them over. In the UK, O2 or 3 or these other carriers are in a position to hand over all your messages.
In the UK, that the police in the UK had to, with some urgency, go to MI5 because their regular surveillance techniques didn't work with BlackBerry Messenger.
Now, it may be that the companies were not willing to provide the assistance, or it may be that, but I mean, the fact that MI5 can get the messages suggests that they're not bulletproof, right? I mean, there are technologies that I use to communicate with my colleagues that MI5, I don't think, has a way to break. And it's not, you know, that I'm a secret agent. It's just that I'm choosing tools for security, and the BlackBerry customers are just using whatever comes on their phone. And it just happens to be that their phone is more secure than a text message. But anything is more secure than a text message. I mean, a voice call is more secure than a text message because your text message is there forever, or at least until the company deletes it. Your voice call is fleeting. So I think that story was overblown. I think it was largely used as a way for the British government to lay the groundwork for future really horrible legislation. They can say, we had these riots, we couldn't wiretap people, we need new wiretapping powers. And that's given them something to point to in the future. Sorry, I'm such a cynic.
Actually, my question was Lissy's question. It was the same question. Isn't he great? We need more of you in the world. This was a great, very informative talk. Thank you so much, Chris.